today's podcast at the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology, exploring transforming relationships at the intersection of text, soul, and culture. I'm Dwight Friesen, and I'm part of the Seattle School's faculty, and today I am joined by author, theologian, professor, emergent thinker, theoblogger, ecclesial innovator, and creator of the Ordain Thyself app, the Reverend, the Doctor,
keep going,
Anthony. Anthony, is it Hawthorne? Hawthorne Jones?
Yeah, it is. It is, actually. Thanks for remembering my middle name.
Yeah, Tony Jones, welcome to the Seattle School.
Thanks, Dwight. It's great to be here.
Good to have you with us. So, there's a lot of things we could talk about today. I think I saw on the forum that we highlighted this as sort of practical theology and spiritual practices and so on. But we'll get to that by the nature of our conversation, I would assume. But I'm really curious what you make of this past Tuesday and the election that took place. And what does it mean that to our country, to Christianity in America, that a Mormon got 80% of the evangelical vote?
I think it's fascinating because you know, we grew up being told that the Mormon church is a cult, right? I mean,
right.
It was in Larson's Book of Cults on my youth
for
pastor's
sure. Yep.
Shelf.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, and it wasn't one of the really bad, nefarious cults, but it was a cult nonetheless. And I grew up in a pretty centrist, mainline-y type of church. So for more hardcore evangelicals, there was just no question, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but it just shows, of course, I mean, this is nothing. This isn't earth-shattering analysis here, but it just shows how evangelicalism really, for a lot of people, maybe for most people, it's like a cultural category or a silo that they find themselves in. It's really not a theological movement anymore.
Right.
I mean, that was the foundation of it, whether you trace it back to the five fundamentals of the late 19th century or, you know, Billy Graham and Harold Ockingay in the 1940s or the foundation of Fuller Seminary or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, surely it was like some kind of theological distinctives. But now, I think if I were a sociologist and I were going to be trying to determine if somebody's an evangelical, I would ask them, like, what radio station you listen to.
Right.
You know, like, where do you buy books? Do you take Christianity Today or Time Magazine?
Right.
Like, or Charisma? Or, like, it's these cultural markers. It's not, do you believe that Jesus was fully human and fully divine?
Right.
Or, like, do you think the penal substitutionary atonement is the right way to understand Jesus' death or something?
Yeah, no doubt. Even the personal conversion thing. I don't even know if I hear people talking about that as much anymore.
You really don't.
It's bizarre.
I don't either. So I think, nevertheless, it was shocking, and I blogged about it and got loads and loads of traffic on my blog when I wrote about, you know, Billy Graham basically endorsing Mitt Romney. And then that very day, or the day after they met, all the instances where the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association website referred to Mormonism as a cult disappeared.
I know.
The next day.
Yeah. Yeah. So apparently all you have to do now to get your cult made mainstream is get a presidential candidate and have them meet with Billy Graham.
Yeah. Now, of course, they would have. I'm sure Billy and Franklin and their whole posse would have been much happier with Rick Perry or Michelle Bachmann or Tim Pawlenty.
Right.
But, you know, you take what you can get. Right.
Yep, right.
And they took what they got. Now, here's what'll be interesting to see. You know, many of the pollsters were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And although Romney carried 80% of evangelicals, it was always my contention that a lot of evangelicals will just stay home. They'd rather not pull the lever for a Mormon.
Hmm.
And they're not going to pull the lever for Obama, so they just didn't go.
Huh.
And I wonder here's an interesting thing that happened in Minnesota is that in a very deeply cynical political ploy, the Republican legislature, state legislature, put two amendments on the ballot, a marriage amendment and a voter ID amendment.
What was the voter ID amendment? Basically,
you have to have a picture,
kind of the immigration
government
thing.
ID. And they did it. They've now said they put those on the ballot a year and a half ago to drive social conservatives to the polls in an incumbency presidential election.
Get out of here.
Oh, no. They've admitted it. Like Republican operatives, not the politicians, of course, but the staffers and stuff, they're like, that's why we did it.
Interesting.
Because they thought, well, we want to keep control of the state legislature with a with an incumbent president who's so popular. We're not going to, you know, social conservatives won't come out and vote, Catholics and evangelicals. So let's put these two. Well, what happened is it totally backfired. Both polls lost. The voter ID amendment was winning by 20 points in the polls 2 weeks before the election, and it lost by 7 points.
Amazing.
And the marriage amendment lost as well.
Yeah.
And
the marriage amendment was between a one man and one woman.
Right.
That was the idea, right?
And both houses of the Minnesota legislature went Democratic.
Amazing.
They lost everything. The Republicans doubled down on these social issues.
So what do you think that's, what does that say about our culture? What's
well,
happening?
Here's what, you know, the analysis I've been reading, and I think this should be interesting to leaders in the church. The analysis I've been reading about the presidential election is that people said, all the experts said, this is all about the economy. Mm. So Romney, it was jobs, 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 right? Those were his three main things, jobs, jobs, jobs. That's it. He wouldn't talk about his Mormonism.
Yep.
He didn't do like the in-depth interview with 60 Minutes where they show his family and his grandkids and da-ba-da-ba-da. He was just like laser beam on message.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the economy. And in I don't know nationwide, but in Minnesota, wasn't about the economy. It was a voter ID amendment and a marriage amendment, and people were pissed. Like young urban hipsters, I drove by three or four polling places in like the hipster urban part of Minneapolis, three block long lines.
Hmm.
And when I went to vote in my like white, rich Republican suburb, no line.
No way.
Yeah, for sure. So social issues still matter to people.
Yeah.
It's just the different people than what the evangelicals tell you the social social issues matter.
If you had Franklin here to talk with right now, Franklin Graham, what would you – I mean, what does this do to the legacy of Billy? And
I think it tarnishes the legacy of Billy Graham. Billy Graham – It was I don't know, 10 years ago when the White House, the Nixon White House tapes came out because the whatever statute of limitations came, they released them. And then it shows Billy Graham bad-mouthing Jews. And I mean, it was dirty stuff. And he repented of it. He regretted it. And he said, it was a mistake for me to ever be political. I want to be a pastor to politicians. I never want to be political. And since Nixon, I haven't been.
Mm-hmm.
I just think Franklin is using his dad like a puppet. You know, it's really sad.
Hmm.
Even where Franklin's burying his parents or like against his parents' wishes, and the guy just I don't know him, but he just seems like not a nice person.
Yeah, I would love Billy's legacy not to end on this kind of a note. You know,
it is though. I mean, this is how Billy Graham is now going to be remembered. Honestly,
right.
Somewhat of a culture warrior and on the losing side.
Right, right.
You know.
Hey, I have been intrigued by your writing on a number of levels. And one of them is that you have – so I'm kind of shifting gears here for a second.
Sure.
You have written extensively on spiritual or sort of identity formation issues, spiritual practices, prayer, so on and so forth. You've also written sort of from another perspective on – sort of the occasional theological concerns, emerging church themes, changing ways of doing youth ministry. You've written on atonement, on sort of some practical theology or challenging issues and so on. They almost seem like in some ways they could be almost like opposing or contradictory or paradoxical.
Yeah.
You got the spiritual formation thing on the one side and you're theologically jabbing on the other side at times. Does that feel accurate? Does that feel accurate to you?
I think that's probably true. I think if you ask my literary agent, she'd say, damn, I wish Tony would just like pick a lane, you know, like develop a career and write about, like, you know, that's what Phil Yancey does. Seems to work for him. Why do you feel like you have to have these two?
Are they connected? Are they
well? They are in my mind. I don't know that they're. I don't know that I've fully connected them in my kind of literary arc.
Hmm.
And my next book may. I think my next book probably will.
Okay, so what are you working on?
So I took a long time to finish my dissertation.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations, by
thank
the way.
Thank you. Thank you. Long time coming. And for like the last 2 years, I kept writing other books that like people were actually paying me to write, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I was reaching that statute of limitations on when you have to finish your dissertation by or if they kick you out, mm-hmm. you know? So I took a moratorium on all other writing and I just wrote my dissertation. And then when I got done with that, I basically put it to my readers, honestly, on my blog. And then there's this little widgety thing you can use on Facebook where you ask a question and people can just vote with a click.
Yep.
And so I asked, well, what should I write my next book on? I put it to the readers. I kind of open sourced it, you know. And I was like, well, people, maybe I should write about sexuality because people kind of know me as someone who's a pro-gay inclusion theologian in, mm-hmm. in the Protestant world. I thought people would want me to write about that. Or maybe another book on the church and what's wrong with the church and how to fix it or something like that. And overwhelmingly, the answer was prayer. I mean, it was – I don't know. I kept the stats. What? So I was like, well, I don't really pray anymore. So
what is prayer for you then these
that's
days?
That's what's tricky, right? I thought I do not want to write a book on prayer because I really – struggle with it. Like, I don't know about you, but a lot of the people that we have been palling around with for the past 15 years in the emergency type world, a lot of people, I'm not going to name names or anything, but a lot of people have a really hard time with the idea of an interventionist God.
Hmm.
There seems to be very little empirical evidence of it. And if God is intervening in kind of the space-time continuum, it's done in such an arbitrary fashion that it seems very ungodlike.
So is this sort of a modified or neo-deism kind of vision?
I mean, that's not where I want to go with it, but I sometimes wonder that when I talk to other people if that's what it is, if it's some kind of – and I mean I know definitely know people who've kind of fallen away from or walked away from conventional Christianity toward that kind of deism position.
Mm-hmm.
And they just can't solve the theodicy question.
Right.
And so they just say, there's no good answer. There's just no good answer.
Yeah,
and you're
yeah.
you're all just playing mind games with yourselves to
– Well, it makes me think a little bit of Christian Smith's work on – and his diagnosis of our culture, the dominant theological language is being – what do you say?
Moralistic
theistic
deism. Therapeutic
deism. Therapeutic. There it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean that's one way to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Although most of those people wouldn't actually admit that they're deists.
Right.
But he's just saying
noticing it or
when you talk to them, that's how it sounds.
Right.
So I was
I'm not there.
Okay.
I mean, maybe I'm still naive. I don't know. Maybe I'm unenlightened, probably. But I find myself in some ways, actually, I feel like my prayer life, I feel odd saying this now. I feel as though my prayer life has become more active in the last 10 years. Than at any other point in my life.
Huh.
And if you would have asked, you know, as a kid, I grew up with the notebook where I kept my Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and I had my prayer list. And
then you checked off the ones that were answered.
Exactly. And I kept note of them the whole deal, you know, and had my little utmost with his highest and worked through it every day and prayed through my Proverbs every night.
Well, I didn't ever.
I was hardcore, man.
A lot of us were hardcore in high school. You know, I wasn't that hardcore for sure, but I mean, I had my utmost for his
I'll pray for you. I'll add you to Tuesday going forward.
A lot of people do pray for me.
You're a lucky man.
Yeah. Isn't it funny when you read my utmost for his highest now, what crap theology it is? I mean, it's crap theology.
I actually went back to it a few years ago. I thought, you know, I have not picked this up in like a decade. And horrid. I was like, holy cow, I can't
It's
read
really
it
horrid theology.
It is.
As is C.S. Lewis.
What?
yes.
Say more. Give us a glimpse into
C.S. Lewis is a theological hack. He might have been a great literary critic. He was a decent children's novelist. But as a theologian, have you read Mere Christianity lately?
I have not.
Do. if you think that is persuasive apologetics,
well, I find the whole endeavor of apologetics to be just misplaced.
Yeah, he's a man of his time. It's very modern, but you just read it now and you think like the trilemma, really? Like, like that's just an open and shut case, right? There's no other options. These are your Lord, Liar, Lunatic.
Right.
Duh.
Well, of course. What else could there be?
Nothing. So, anyway.
You can't dog C.S. Lewis, can you, and still be a person of faith?
You can if, you can if you're a freelance theologian.
Okay. Okay.
You probably can't.
Well, I was going to say, I might pay for this interview already.
I can.
I have a colleague who is a...
Say you dramatically disagree with me on, while we're recording, and you'll
okay,
be fine.
Okay, there we go.
I would say that the book on prayer is really going to be my attempt to talk about God, who God is, what's the nature of God, what's the nature of our relationship with God, because I really do see a dilemma, and that is God is either actively responding to our prayers in a very arbitrary fashion, or God is not... or God is responding to our prayers based on some calculus that we don't understand, in which case God's activity is contingent upon our activity, which a lot of people think.
Hmm.
When you look around, when you watch when you watch TBN, like that's all those people think, is if you pray this certain way, then God does stuff.
Right.
But that's not God. Well,
no.
At least that's not that's not like the Platonic, Aristotelian, traditional conception of what God is.
Hmm.
Which I continue to maintain.
Hmm.
That if there's God, then there's God has to fit some certain definition. And a God who's a contingent being is a demiurge, not a God.
Hmm.
I think there's a big difference there.
So then how are you making sense of, or do you engage at all with some of Clayton's work or the open theism folks? Is that
I think open theism is like process theology light. You know, open theism is we were talking before we went on about preterism. I was talking about preterism. You weren't. You were
right.
Telling me how much you love preterism.
Well, was I now?
No. What I say to preterists is kind of the same thing I say to open theists. Like,
do people know what preterism is? Maybe say a word about that.
Oh, preterism is this very sliver of a minority opinion that all of the prophecies of the Bible came to fulfillment in the year 70 when the temple was destroyed. So all the prophecies of the Old and New Testaments were about the temple being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And there are multiple problems with that, including that all the canonical books of the New Testament had to be written before 70, which almost no New Testament scholar believes.
Right.
For sure the Gospel of John is post-70, right? But
mm-hmm.
a preterist is basically a biblical literalist who has to kind of figure out ways to make it work when you read, you know, surely not one generation will pass away before these things come to pass, or this kind of thing.
Right.
Well, if he said that, I mean...
Right. It must be...
He must have meant it.
Right, in the most literal sense.
Yeah, and so... I think in some ways when I see open theism, I think, well, that's just kind of like evangelicals who are a little squirrely and trying to make sense of a God who is still really bound to that text.
Yep.
Really bound to the biblical text in a way that like Phil Clayton or the process people at Claremont, they are not that concerned with the text.
Right.
The text is a nice jumping off point, but so I'm somewhere in between there. Process theology, those guys jump up and down and tell me that God is some kind of a distinct being with whom I can have relationship. They say that process theology teaches that. And I say, I don't
see it in there.
I don't see it.
Yep.
It's not convincing. Plus, I also kind of say to them, look, you had your shot.
Right.
Like the 70s. They were all yours. You didn't do anything with it. We don't have like whole denominations of if that had taken off like... We like Wesley did. We'd have, like we have United Methodist churches everywhere. We'd have
some kind of process.
First Church of Process,
right.
Christianity,
right.
In every downtown. We don't. It just didn't.
It doesn't engender the same kind of commitment.
True, for sure, which is what worries me about my theological program, that it doesn't either.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, it scares the hell out of me.
So what are you passing on to your kids? I mean, you write a lot on formation. You write
awesome
a lot on
genes.
True enough. True.
A love of hunting.
You're a hunter?
Oh, yeah, I kill things.
Oh, part of me just died.
Did you eat chicken today?
Not today.
Yesterday?
I might have. I'm not opposed to things dying.
Somebody kill. You want them to die a natural death and then you'll eat them?
Well,
do you eat roadkill? Is that what? Because last weekend I shot a pheasant. I took out a Bowie knife.
Beautiful.
I gutted it.
Yeah.
My dog brought it back to me after. I mean, my dog flushed it. I shot it. My dog brought it back to me.
A man of the woods.
I field dressed it. I brought it home. And I made pheasant pot pie for my kids, and they ate it up.
Love it.
So yes, I'm a killer of things.
No, my biggest thing is roughing it for me is like thin towels at the hotel. Like the idea of sitting out in some kind of like a.
I'll tell you this.
I just can't do it.
I'll tell
it's
you
miserable.
This. So I took my two sons. I took my two sons out duck hunting last month, and shot a duck. You know,
congratulations. What do you say to that?
But I only winged it. So the dog goes out. You know, they love this dog. He sleeps on the bed with them or whatever. And he goes out and he brings back this duck. And this duck is totally alive. All I did was break its wing. It couldn't fly away. The dog brings back this totally alive duck. And so what you do is then you wring its neck. You know that old?
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, you actually do that.
Nice.
And so I did it in front of my kids, and the look on their faces was one of shock and horror.
Huh.
I mean, it really is.
It is.
You don't. We are very far removed.
Yep.
From our ancestors, all killed animals all the time.
The big family reunion when I was growing up as a kid. My dad was one of 12 kids. We'd gather on the family homestead, butcher pigs, and make sausage.
Yeah.
I make pheasant sausage
every year. I just made pheasant sausage. 2 weeks ago.
It was disgusting.
With those pheasants.
I have to say.
It's totally disgusting. You're running meat and fat through a grinder.
Oh.
I mean, it's – and then casing it in pig intestine.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not pleasant, but it tastes great.
Oh, it sure does. It sure does.
So my kids are – I don't apologize for the fact that my kids are kind of experiencing that. What am I – but that wasn't what you were really asking.
That's not what I was asking. Like when you think about what – like I mean, why are you a theologian?
Well,
I mean, it could be just that career choices have gotten you here. I mean, you've got the PhD, so you may as well use it. But
I love it. I love debating, talking, thinking about the nature of God and the nature of humankind and our interaction with God, whatever God may be. Hmm. I just find it totally fascinating.
Is whoever an appropriate...
Sure, or whoever.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
Or whoever.
Now, I have a question about debate. I mean, I am typically not... I mean, you've known me long enough to know that I am not really a debater.
No, you're a lover.
I'm a lover. would you describe me that way, or are you just being an ass?
In fact, I tell people that all the time.
You tell people I'm a lover?
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you. I think I'm going to take that as a compliment. For me, now this could be that I grew up as a Canadian Mennonite.
Maybe.
Apologetic
you think,
person.
You think that has anything to do with it?
Well, it
with
might.
The beard, the whole thing?
Maybe. You know, I'm just saying maybe. But for me, debate seems counter-Christian. It seems like debate sets up a conversation almost it controls a conversation. It seeks to control definitions such that there's a winner and a loser. How do you help me with
really?
This? Teach me about debate as
man.
A Christian enterprise.
I think there are rarely winners and losers in the debates that I'm talking about that I've been engaged in, because people are rarely convinced
of course.
One side or the other.
Right.
But the thing for me is that when I get into debates, whether they be online, like I blog back and forth and I debate somebody in my post and they write a post or whether I do it in some kind of public format, there are a lot of people listening in.
Hmm.
There are a lot of fence sitters who are trying to figure this whole thing out.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who read my blog who go to seminary.
Right.
Sure, there are a lot of clergy and there are a lot of faculty, blah, blah. But there are a lot of Christian college kids who read my blog, because my blog's like the naughty blog for a Christian college kid to read. You
right,
know?
Right.
There are dirty limericks on my blog and heretical theology. But they're like...
Not really. I was reading through your atonement book the other day.
The atonement book is not. Peter Rollins texted me 2 days ago, and he's like, I just read your atonement book, and I'm so mad at you for how orthodox you are.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd never heard you sound so orthodox.
He's
truly
disappointed in me. Which I said to Peter, I could probably find the text. I texted him back, and I said something like, Peter, you must affirm the resurrection in order to deny it.
Oh, very Rollins of you.
Yes. He had no reply. I got
which was his reply.
Right. I got the last word, but it's right.
How
it's
not
so
to
true.
Speak like, of Tony.
How completely unorthodox for me to affirm a historical resurrection. What is he going to do with that? He doesn't know what to do with that. I totally nailed him. It was awesome.
It's great.
So, and I got to still teach at Fuller.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah.
I mean, guys got to put food on the table.
No doubt. So, back to passing on to your kids.
Oh, boy. I was trying to avoid that.
The formation piece. Like, what's it about?
Osmosis.
Okay. Say more.
Well, I mean, we talk about God.
But when your son loses his flashlight while you're out hunting,
yeah,
and if you had lost your flashlight hunting with your dad, and you would have probably stopped and prayed that God would help you find
it.
Oh
my gosh!
That wouldn't have. Okay, so
it wouldn't happen with my dad. It might have happened with my mom. It would not happen with me and my son.
Okay,
that because I guess I don't want to engender in them this idea that God is their cosmic butler.
Uh huh.
God doesn't give a crap if you lost your flashlight.
Okay, great.
Like pray about Darfur if you're going to pray about something. Like
yes,
you know, pray about ending the war in Afghanistan for God's sakes. Screw your flashlight.
So does God not care about your flashlight?
Right. God does not care about your flashlight.
And God does not care about the things that are on your mind, on your heart, and the things that you are experiencing?
Well, look, you're going to keep layering things on until we pass some kind of threshold where it sounds absolutely ridiculous of me to say that God doesn't care about blah, blah, blah. Does God care about the things that are on your heart and mind? I suppose, but I don't really have that conception of God as this other being in that sense anymore.
Okay. Is that a more panentheistic kind of?
Yes, for sure, panentheistic. Not like this Bardian other God who's outside the space-time continuum and breaks in with these moments of personal revelation or corporate revelation.
Gotcha.
Not that. No, God is much more enamored of creation than that and much more embracing of creation than that.
And part of creation?
Yeah, for sure.
So God doesn't in any way stand apart from the created order?
God does in some way stand apart from the created order. Because God, you know, in the Kabbalistic tradition, God, which I find very compelling, that God had to withdraw God's self enough for there to be a creation that's other than God.
Right.
But where Moltmann does with that is then say, but then in the Trinity, and particularly in the crucifixion and resurrection, that in the resurrection event, the love of the Trinity becomes so overwhelming that it overflows itself and re-embraces all of creation back into itself.
Lovely.
So if God did have to and also I think this it's called Zimzum, this Kabbalistic doctrine of God's self-limitation. If at creation God's very first act is one of self-limitation, well, I think that meshes very well with the the hymn of Philippians 2, that the whole activity of Christ is an activity of God's self-humiliation, self-limitation. So I wouldn't say God's nature is one of self-limitation, but if the nature of God's relationship with creation is one of self-limitation, then it starts a creation with God saying, I'm going to withdraw myself enough for there to be a creation that is other than me. And then to the point that for Christians, the ultimate act of self-limitation is that God would take on human form and literally suffer the death of God. Like God suffers.
Yes.
I actually believe that God died. God suffered death. God experienced that in the ultimate act of solidarity with all creation. That duck whose neck I wrung and me who will someday have my neck wrung you know, by cancer or a bus or
John also, Piper.
Or John Piper, it could be.
Sure.
We live not that far away. If I get hit by a bus, the last thing I may see is John Piper driving the bus. Right? But that's God's ultimate. So their God, it's this continual acts of self-limitation.
I think. Mm-hmm. Which kind of bridges to your most recent book. I mean, the most recent one was your ebook called A Better Atonement, which I just finished reading over the weekend and absolutely loved.
It's a good toilet read. If you're not afraid of dropping your Kindle in the toilet, since it's only an ebook.
Right, right. So why that book for you right now? Why was that? What drove you to write that one?
I had finished my dissertation. Yeah, I had finished it, I guess. And I was, I just felt like there was something in the water. Like Christians in my little corner of the blogosphere, people were talking about the atonement.
Mm-hmm.
John Piper jumps up and down and screams about the atonement, and Mark Driscoll does, and people on the liberal end where I kept seeing people were referring to Rene Girard, and like I knew about his scapegoating theory, but I'd never read it. And then you got Greg Boyd, naming his ministry Christus Victor Ministries.
Right.
Like it just like in our little tribe of kind of post-Protestant Protestant, people seemed to be real intrigued in the atonement. I thought, and every time I blogged about the atonement, I got good traffic, like people commented, people got real jazzed up about it and wanted to argue about it in the comments and this and that. People post link to it and this and that. And so I just thought to myself, well, I think I've written quite a bit about the atonement on my blog. Let me see how many words that comes up to. And it was like 10,000 words I'd written on the atonement. And it's not, the beginning part is about the original sin and then about me affirming the historical resurrection, which is the most a/theistic thing I could do,
mm-hmm.
Peter Rollins,
yep.
Trademark. And then I had all this stuff about these different versions of the atonement, and plus it was Lent. Like, I was like, this is when people think about it, and I just decided I got enough for an ebook here. So I, and I'd already done another ebook on my views on marriage.
Yep.
But man, that atonement ebook took off. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Between like, I put it together. I just taught myself how to format for the Kindle and do some coding and whatever and got it up on Amazon. And in the 2 weeks before Easter, it sold like 2,000 copies. It was shocking to me. And again, I self-published my dissertation too, but I want you – can we do a little role play?
Is that the world is flat? I mean the church is flat?
Church is flat.
That was your dissertation? I didn't realize that was your dissertation.
I did a search replace where I like search dissertation, change to book. That was all I did, and then I published it.
You did not.
I kid you not. That's all I did, right?
So awesome.
So it's like, this dissertation, I will argue. Now it just says, in this book, I will argue. That's it. That's all I did, and then I published it. Because I want you – let's do a little role play.
Okay.
You be a Christian publisher. Like, let's say you work at Baker, Harper One.
Okay, sure. Yep.
Hi, Mr. Publisher.
Hey, Tony. Good to see you.
I've got a book idea.
Tell me a little bit about it.
I want to write a book on the doctrine of the atonement.
Okay.
It's 14,000 words, so that'd be about 48 pages.
Yep.
I would like it to be ready a week from now.
You know, that's not going to happen.
And I'd like you to sell it for $2.99, and I would like a 70% royalty. Can we do that?
Oh, no, I don't think so. No, I'm not going to run it by a few folks. But
let me go to the editorial board.
Exactly.
You're going to go to that. So you see what I'm saying?
Totally.
Like, same thing with my dissertation. I thought, well, I could go to Erdman's. I could go to some academic house and say, "Here's my dissertation," and they'd be like, "Great.
Yep.
Your research is 4 years old, redo your research, and then come back, then bring it back to us." So I'd spend a year rewriting my dissertation, which all that, I mean, like, you know, by the end, you're ready to put a bullet in your head. Like, if you have
kill
to
kill me
read,
now, if you, I have to read this thing,
if you
again.
Have to read that, and then they're like, "Oh, yeah, spend a year revising it."
Yeah.
And I don't have any TAs to do that for me, unlike you.
yeah, because I have so many of those.
Exactly.
That's right. We call them AIs, by the way.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah, Princeton, they're called preceptors.
Ooh, preceptors.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Isn't that
what does that mean?
Get over yourself.
it is Princeton.
It is, and I was a preceptor of mom. So then, you know, I would have spent a year revising it. Then I would have gone into the publishing house. They would have spent a year editing it.
And yep.
That's code for sitting on an editor's desk, not being looked at.
Exactly.
And then they finally publish it. And then it's,
and they'd butcher your cover and they'd butcher your title.
I kid you not. That's right. They wouldn't have gone with The Church is Flat. And by the way, let me just say on the Atonement book, when you come up with a subtitle like Beyond the Depraved Doctrine of Original Sin, you have to write the book. Like if you come up with a subtitle that good, you have to write
the book. Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Hey, listen. We're going to move to questions in a couple of minutes from our with those who are with us here at the Seattle School.
You've heard them laughing in the background.
In the past, when you were moderator at some of the emergent theological conversations over the years,
don't you miss those?
Oh, I do miss those. Really those were too. Such great times.
I know.
And thank you for your work on those over the years.
I loved it. Those were such good times. Yeah.
You would often throw a few names out to people invite them to sort of do a stream of conscious responding to the names that you would throw at them.
I did.
I just have a handful of names here that
gosh,
I thought.
Gosh, why would you do this to me?
I don't know. I just thought how fun would that be to...
Turnabout is fair play.
It just seems like it might be. But so
I'll be Karnak here.
So you ready to go?
No.
Okay. First one, Stanley Hauerwas.
You want me to respond with like a one sentence?
Or? Yeah. Well, whatever you had them had people do. Isn't that kind of what you had them do?
I think Hauerwas has an enormous footprint in the Theological Academy right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he is supremely idealistic about what the church can actually be.
Hmm.
He should have gone to be a pastor for a while before he taught seminary.
Hmm. St. Augustine.
A deeply sincere man of his time who is trying to bridge a Platonic understanding of God with a Hebraic man-God.
Mm-hmm.
And so developed the doctrine of the Trinity, among other things, but a little dismissive of his opponents.
Mm-hmm. Rachel Held Evans.
What would I say? Deceptively brilliant.
How about Mark Driscoll?
Brilliantly deceptive.
Okay. Doug Padgett?
The single most loyal, best friend that a human being could ever have.
Mm.
And deceptively, like undereducated for an incredible intellect, which gives him actually insight that those of us who are traditionally educated get beaten out of us in the academy.
Mm, that's good. Phyllis Tickle.
Like a third grandmother to me and incredible proponent of my work and the person who, when everyone else said, oh, emergent is over, that was a fad. The single authoritative voice who has kept that conversation relevant for the last 5 years.
Yeah, so true. You've mentioned this person already, but Jürgen Moltmann?
My theological muse, a man of his time and of his theological era and of his context of post-World War II Germany, and yet brilliantly creative theological method, which I find great solace in. That if he gets to be that all over the map, then we get to
to play too.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. How about N.T. Wright?
Too conservative for my taste, but the best popularizer of the most current work being done in biblical studies. I mean, somebody I would actually like to emulate in practical theology. I'd like to do for theology what N.T. Wright does for New Testament.
And I think you're doing that in a lot of ways.
Thank you.
How about Philip Clayton?
A guy who wants to change the world And if his ADHD doesn't get in the way, he probably will change the world. I mean, somebody who can combine so much knowledge about science, about theology, and about leading a theological institution into the future, I don't know how he does it all, but he seems to be pulling it off.
Yeah, he does. To say a word about Diana Butler Bass.
Diana and I have had our differences in the past, significant differences. But she's come around to my way of thinking, so we're on a lot better terms now. She's less bullish on the future of the mainline in her latest book than she has been. And we challenge each other, which I think is really good because we both, I think, have some hard words for mainline Christianity. But she has earned her platform, every bit of her platform. She works her tail off. She does her homework. And you can read her books and see her evolution, which I appreciate that most about any scholar.
How about last one will be Miroslav Volf?
Miroslav was very kind to me when I was in my early 20s, when he was at Fuller. And then after I graduated, I went to see him in Europe. And I actually went to see him in Croatia, like in a bus that was weaving UN tanks with the guys in the light blue helmets, you know. I think Miroslav is brilliant and a man of deep conviction. And I hope that he will continue to popularize his work, because I worry that it gets so esoteric that it's out of reach of most people. Yeah.
Thank you. We're going to move to some question and response from those who are here. And if you can be so kind as to give us your name and then state your question, we'd appreciate it.
Crickets.
Happens.
Hi, my name is Karen. When we were talking at the beginning about Billy Graham and the state of the country, more just, I guess, a comment than a question, but I've spent 27 years overseas and returned recently and found it of very great interest to read Frankie Schaeffer's Sex, Mom, and God book.
Yeah.
And I think I've missed out on a lot of America's history while I've been away, but I found that absolutely fascinating to hear his take on why we got to where we are today.
Yeah.
And his involvement in all of that history. So I don't know if you've read that book, but
I have. Frank and I met each other at the Wild Goose Festival a couple years ago and became fast friends. And the first book I read by him was Crazy for God. And what's interesting is, maybe kind of like you, honestly, I had maybe heard the name Francis Schaeffer a couple times in my college years when I was in Campus Crusade, but we didn't. When I talk to people now, we're like, oh, when I was in high school, like, we all read, that's all my youth pastor read was Francis Schaeffer, and we watched these videotapes of Francis Schaeffer. You, yeah,
oh yeah,
I'd never heard of the guy.
I've read his entire six volumes. Yeah,
okay, so that just wasn't my version of Christianity growing up. So I read this Crazy for God about what his dad and mom were like by the son, you know. And it's fascinating to me. And I'm glad that I don't have to. Here's what I'm glad about. And I'm friends with Frank, and I'm friends with Jay Baker, Jim and Tammy Faye's son. And I've been friends in the past with, I've known James Dobson's son and Josh McDowell's son. And we've been talking about Franklin Graham. We're in a very intriguing moment right now. And some of us have watched even what happened with Robert Shuler's kids. I know Chuck Smith Jr. We're in this funny time where all the sons and a few daughters, but mainly the sons of these pioneers of megachurch, pioneers of television ministry, radio ministry with Billy Graham, you know, and huge rallies. They're all kind of, they're now coming of that age, right? And they all have so much this cross to bear and to try to deal with this. And Frank's dealing with it one day. And today it was on the plane, sitting in the plane waiting for them to close the cabin door and scrolling through Twitter. And I thought to myself, sometimes Frank Schaeffer shouldn't be on Twitter. because he was just going on and on about the Republican Party and how horrible they are, and RIP GOP. And I'm like, Frank, the Republican Party is not dead, brother. You know, he's got so much angst because he had such a part in building the religious right. Then you got my buddy Jay Baker, who's one of my closest friends, and he's got all sorts of other angsts. You know, his have to do with money, not surprisingly, right? After what he grew up with. And I'm just glad I went into a different line of work than my father. And I think that some of these guys, it's just interesting to watch them grow and develop and kind of, they've got this chip on their shoulder, some kind of thing they've got to work through. And a lot of them are doing it publicly. You know, some of them are doing it privately, but a lot are doing it publicly.
You know, there was early in his career, Frankie wrote a book called Sham Pearls for Real Swine.
Oh, yeah?
Which was kind of, for me, it was the first text that I read that invited me into back into the arts.
Really?
That book, I would imagine he would be ashamed of it today, or he would certainly have different ways of seeing or articulating. Yeah. But that book opened up or invited me back into the world of beauty that I am so, to this day, it's one of those books I look back to with such gratitude.
Well, you should tweet that to him. I should. He'd love to hear it.
I should.
Yeah.
Another question. Keep it coming. Be thinking about your question.
Hi, I'm Rachel.
Hi.
You spoke briefly about, or maybe not briefly, but about kind of your motivation for writing your atonement book and how there was kind of a lot of chatter around that topic. And yeah. I was wondering if, kind of besides, like one person talks about it, so people want to respond, but if you have thoughts around kind of why trends like that exist or why there might be a lot of interest at one certain time.
Yeah. Well, as opposed to what Dwight said earlier, I think that the history of theology is a lot of debate. I'm sure you wouldn't disagree with that.
No, not at all.
There's a lot of debate. And so you look back at, Aquinas was a student at the University of Paris. He was the smartest student on campus, but he was just a student when the faculty at the University of Paris was becoming confronted with this new philosophy none of them had ever read before. They hadn't even heard of this person named Aristotle before. But there were Muslim philosophers and theologians who had kept Aristotle's writings for all these centuries, and they were developing theology around Aristotle's philosophy. And everything in the Christian West was Platonic. And so they were very much challenged by this. So his tutors actually, because he was so smart, so clearly so much smarter than they were, his tutors came to him with those writings of Aristotle and said, can you do something with these? And he ends up writing an Aristotelian, in his two summas, like 20 volumes worth of basically Aristotelian theology. You'd say the same thing, Augustine did the same thing when he debated Pelagius on the nature of grace or on the nature of God's sovereignty and predestination and free will. And so I think these things come up because they're, you know, they're cultural moments that happen. And people wonder about them. One thing that's very interesting about the atonement, you know, like I said, some of these neo-Calvinist people jump up and down and get red in the face about the atonement. But here's the thing about the atonement. It's not an issue of orthodoxy, not historically speaking, because there is neither a creed nor a council that weighs in on a particular understanding of the atonement. You can say that the divinity and humanity of Christ is an issue of orthodoxy because of the Council of Chalcedon. You can say that the Trinity, because of the Apostles' Creed and Nicene Creed, that's a standard of orthodoxy. You cannot say that about why Jesus died on the cross. Because neither the creeds nor the councils debated it. It was not an issue of orthodoxy for them. So I think that in that particular doctrine, that gives us some room to play and say, look at all the different options we have.
Well, and I find myself wondering whether part of the reason why the atonement is so hot right now is because the telos of evangelicalism seems to have lost its way. I mean, we don't know what that is anymore.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, and so for a long time, evangelicals defined themselves as saving the lost.
Sure, sure. And just think of like the millions and millions of kids who went to Young Life camp
right.
over the last 30 years, 40 years. And we're told Jesus died for your sins. And you get to a certain, you know, you're like, oh, okay, I accept him into my heart. But then you get to a certain point, like maybe in philosophy 101, freshman year in college or whatever, where you're like, how does that work exactly?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are actually the mechanics behind Jesus dying for my sin? And, you know, well, there are people, Young Life staffers who've lost their jobs because they refuse to affirm penal substitutionary atonement. But I'm telling you, that answer is just, as I try to deconstruct it in the book, you know, it's based on this faulty doctrine of original sin. And if you can give up the doctrine of original sin, you don't need penal substitutionary atonement anymore.
Well, and there's entire traditions of the church, as you highlight in your book, that don't begin their theology with original sin.
Right.
Total depravity is not a part of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah.
Another question over here.
Hi, I'm Adam.
Hey.
So, like, in seeing like all these big ideas, all this theology, I'm going to be a pastor. So, what I could say is the role of the pastor in bringing theology to their congregation. Have you ever experienced or been in a church situation where you've been pastored well by someone who used theology a certain way? Because, I mean, the role of a pastor isn't to argue theological doctrine with their congregation. In some ways it is, like to help them learn. But if that's all it is, it feels like something's missing.
Boy, that's a good question. And I don't know that I have a great answer for it. I was in pastoral ministry for about 20 years. Full-time for about 10. And in that time, I worked under pastors who were very good at that and pastors who weren't very good at it. I think one of the things is that I think that a pastor's job, like if you're on a church that's big enough to have a staff, a lot of people go into ministry because they are very intrigued about ideas about God, Jesus, the Bible. They want to talk about those things. They spent 3 years and tens of thousands of dollars in seminary talking about those things. And then you get out and like all you sit in staff meeting and you talk about the coffee policy, or should we change the Wednesday night supper menu, you know, or what's the Advent Bible study going to be on? And I think that at least for head of staff, one of the main things to do is to catalyze theological conversation among the fellow staff. And I've been on church staffs where that really was awesome. And it like people, I actually looked forward to going to staff meetings because we're all reading a book together and we're like really digging, like we're reading an N.T. Wright book or something like that, something substantive. I've also been on church staffs where that never happened. All we talked about was the mundane duties of running a church. And I just thought, I could be working anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It can be obviously done in preaching. It can be done in adult ed. I did it a lot in youth ministry. I mean, I really, probably to a fault, the kids who went through my confirmation class for 7 years, I mean, it wasn't the same kids for 7 years. Although I probably would have liked that if it was a 7-year course in Christianity. They just did it for a year, but they were, you know, I'm sure some of them were like, what is this guy? What is this guy's deal? Always talking about theology, but it's what intrigued me. And then, you know, what's interesting is I always found those kids who were really, really into that too. So, yeah, I'm sure it can be overdone, but I think most churches err on the side of too little theology. Most pastors, in my experience, graduate from seminary and spend the rest of their time reading like business management books. They read like Malcolm Gladwell and Seth Godin and how to make their budget work better, how to be a big idea person. And I wish they'd read, for every one of those books, I wish they would read a theology book. Yeah.
Let's take one more question.
Hey, Tony, I'm Pat. I teach one of the courses on prayer here, and we use your Sacred Wave book.
Oh, awesome.
So I'm curious, as you've talked about your different understanding of prayer, I'm curious just how do you understand connection with the sacred nowadays? How has that view of prayer from that book changed for you?
Oh, that's a good question. I still am very fond of that book. I mean, there's like in that postmodern youth ministry book, I would repudiate about a third of it. All the Hauerwasian stuff.
Hey, no.
Totally would repudiate it. But
everybody makes mistakes.
Yeah.
Repudiation is one of them at times.
The Sacred Way, I'm really fond of that book. I don't know how much I would change. So my prayer life, like the going way back to when I did my research for that book, the Jesus prayer is still probably the core of my prayer life. And I don't know. Connection with the sacred. I've been through a lot in my life since I wrote that book. Been divorced, messy, horrible divorce. Been estranged from my kids. Had my kids come back in my life. Got married to an incredible person. So all of those kind of things have affected my creation. I mean, my connection with the sacred. Of course, to whom you're married has a big, I think, role in how you understand the sacred. And Courtney is very open to the sacred everywhere. And that kind of jibes with my theology of being a panentheist, but I hadn't really been able to put that into practice, or I'd never really put the tires on the ground on that thing. So I think in this book, I'm trying to figure out if you do have a more panentheistic view of God, it can be cliche to say like, well, everything is prayer, right? To say like, when I'm out hunting with my kids, that's prayer. Well, like, how's that prayer? Maybe the flashlight is God. Like what? You know, or whatever. It can become kind of cliche and meaningless, but I want to get right up to the edge of meaninglessness and not quite be meaningless in it and say, there's good. I think where I'm going to land the plane on the book called Why Pray? One Man's Quest for an Answer, or something like that, is that it's ultimately for me, union with Christ is the goal of prayer. In this kind of, what I find very compelling is when I read the Desert Fathers and Mothers, and they talk about these extraordinary moments of divine union, feeling their bodies in flame and feeling demons being chased out of their caves. And I mean, it's really intense stuff. And I think spiritual warfare is baloney, but I find those writings very compelling for some reason. So there's something in there I want to mine the depths of the Philokalia and stuff like that. So that's kind of an answer in process. Hmm. Yeah.
Tony, I think we're coming up on that time. We're going to call it a conversation, but
I'm going to pray that we extend it.
We'll see if God intervenes. One of the things I have just so found and delightful about our conversation is that you embody such a wide open stance. Uh-huh. On the one hand, you are articulating something of union with Christ sort of affirming the resurrection as a historical fact. Uh-huh. And at the same time, questioning other things or the other aspects of the faith that have often been held as or assumed to be hard and fast and accurate and true and all that kind of stuff. That ability to lean in and to be on a quest like you, I just find so attractive about your theological process and
well thanks. That's very kind of you to say. I think a lot of people, you might even say it too, you know, people who knew me 10 years ago or 15 years ago when the emergent church stuff was just taking off were like, oh, you were a real jerk back then, things have changed. If anything, I would say that openness. On the intellectual side, I've been so influenced by Jürgen Moltmann, and he is so open to learning. And you can just – I've read everything he's written multiple times, and you just see him progressing and learning, being open to, you know, what do I have to learn from Freud? What do I have to learn from evolutionary psychology? What do I have to learn from Marx? He's always open to that. And then on the personal side, you know, I've just had stuff happen in my personal life that has kicked the shit out of me.
Yeah.
And So I guess there are different ways you can respond to that. Hmm. But for me, I guess posture toward life now is one of like, I don't really have it all together. I may be an Enneagram 8 who's real loud and has a PhD to wave around, but
maybe.
Yeah, but I definitely don't have it all together. Mm. So.
Well, I'm so glad that you were here to join us today.
Great to be here.
So thank you so much. So that's our podcast today from the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. Blessings.
Thanks.